What's up, dude?
Hey, man. How are you?
I have mixed feelings, as I always have, about starting the podcasts, as I've done so many with, hey, buddy, but I keep doing it. And it's we were talking before I hit record. That's true of every podcast that's ever been made. And I always do that kind of phony, like, what's up? And I think this is the first time I've ever like meta acknowledged it. And I think it's part of the fact that you're on the show today.
Oh, I love that. I like that.
You make me think outside the box, Graham. You're an outside the box fella.
Thank you. So are you.
I am very, very excited to talk to you. I have to give the background, as I usually do, how I know the person. You are not a stranger to me. I've met a lot of new people on this show lately. It's been wonderful, but I love a good catch up. And you and I have not caught up in a long time. And we used to live together for like a while.
Yeah, for like, I think around 2 years, right?
Yeah,
it was a long time.
That's right. In Silver Lake with Mr. Joe Flanders, who's been on the show a couple of times. The three of us were roomies. And overall, I think pretty pleasant experience.
Yeah,
I can say
it was
good. For everybody listening, we don't talk about it since Joe might hear this, but I'm kidding. I love you very much, Joe. We both do. But it was an interesting situation for me because I knew Joe from school. Joe Flanders and I were at school at the same time we made movies together. We knew each other. We hung out. And when I moved to LA, I had plans actually to live with a different person completely.
That
person bailed. And then it just so happened Joe and I both needed a place and we were looking for places together, but we kept finding these three person places that were like a better deal. And he said, I've got a third person. And I was super fucking scared to live with a total stranger that only Joe was vouching for. And I didn't know you at all. I never met you. I never really even heard your name a lot. We hadn't crossed paths, even though we were actually on campus around the same time.
You were the first like stranger that I ever lived with. And I had the same feeling. I remember we met in like a Target or something, right? For some reason.
I have no memory of that, but I believe you completely.
I think I was like eating a pretzel in a Target or something. And like, but
we might have been buying new stuff
really
for the place. Yeah. And we kind of leapt and let the net appear on that one. And I think it worked out pretty good. We had to share a bathroom and everything.
It did. Yeah. And I think that you actually, your higher standards of cleanliness, especially in the bathroom, I think really were helpful to me at that time. It was a growth period for me and that was good.
That's a really, really nice way of calling out how anal retentive I am about trying to keep my space tidy. And you're right.
But it was, I remember you said this thing that I still think about this sometimes. You said, you're like, I want my place to be like, it should always be ready for my parents to come visit. It was something around that sentiment. I was like, yeah, I'm an adult. Like I'm a grown man. This should be a place where people can come and feel comfortable and safe.
Right.
Like, there's not filth everywhere.
It's a weird argument. You know, what's crazy. And I don't want to get on too big of a tangent of people that don't aren't in the room with us, so to speak, but man, that comes from a very specific story. What I used to say was, I want to live at a standard of cleanliness and kind of tidiness. So it's not going to be perfect all the time. I'm really not a compulsive person, but I want to get the call that my parents just landed at the airport. And I have that long to get it to where they can walk in the door.
That's
and
what
not
was,
be
yes.
Like, Jesus, is your life falling apart? Like, it was such a reflection. It seemed like just a reflection on like, how well are you kind of keeping up the world around you? And I remember living in New York City after college. This is where that came from, where I came up with it. I was living with two guys, one of which went to School of the Arts, the other didn't. But both of them, I went to like community theater with them in like middle school. I've known these boys a long time. And I'm living with my, you know, childhood buddies. And there were some small different kinds of disputes that are fun stories, but not relevant, about how we weren't kind of getting along clean wise. And we had kind of a meeting a little round table. I'm like, all right, let's all get on the same page about what we're going to do and keep it together. And this is a big apartment. It's like six people. And wow. two of them are my best friends.
That's like a commune at that point. Six people.
They called it the hostel because they rotated all the time. I was there for like a year, but my two buddies from when I was young, they were there for like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or something. And so many different roommates over all this time. I was one of them. But one of the main ones was my buddy from childhood. And I said that, just kind of pulled it out my ass of like, let me give an example of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to put, like, how do we judge what's clean, what's not clean to me or you? This is where I'm at. I want to live in an apartment, blah, blah, blah. Parents are at the airport, they're on the way. We can get it together in that time, whether that's 30 minutes to an hour. And my buddy from childhood, he goes, oh, no. That was his reaction to the whole thing. He was like, not trying to live under that fucking pressure all the time. Are you kidding me? What is this, like a nightmare you're describing? And I was like,
that was too much. Because when you put it that way, I'm like, that is a completely reasonable, like, to argue that would just reveal like what an animal I am. It's like, that's an inarguable, like,
that's why people don't like me, Graham, is because that's what I present on a regular basis. And they're forced to reckon with the fact that they're like, no, I choose not that life. I don't have to do that. So
love that. No,
you should probably find another place because we're on the lease. And I'm like, that's a really good point. This may not be a good fit, but I'm glad that, you know, one of my future roommates was you, and you took that notion very well.
It was good. I really did enjoy our time together. And that apartment was awesome. The parties that were great. The space was great. That, I have really, really fond memories of that. My time in LA in that space.
Me too. Absolutely. That was like my first apartment in LA, really. And you and Joe were great roommates to have in that way as it relates to moving to Los Angeles, because it felt very like older brother. I mean, Joe's like 20 minutes older than me. You're just like a couple years older than me. But it felt very much like, oh, they've been here. I was so brand new. And you guys are both film guys. And I left the theater geeks to join the film geeks. And I was like, I need the new geeks because I got the wrong geeks in my life, so to speak. You know, we're all into a certain kind of thing out here that I think was really necessary for me, even though you guys were doing very different things. Mm-hmm. It felt like when I came home and I was like, man, on set, blah, 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 that like felt not foreign to the people I was talking to who were like having a play reading or something that wasn't quite that visceral. It was helpful for me too.
Oh, awesome. Good.
Where are you from, Graham Bolin?
Where am I? I'm from my dad was in the Air Force. So we moved around all over the place. So when I was a kid, I lived in like some really boring places, like not the not fun parts of Texas, Georgia, Abilene. I'm sure you know where Abilene is.
I do know where Abilene is. I have quite a bit of family there.
Oh, well, so no shade to Abilene, but.
Oh, it's the slowest, most boring place I can imagine.
Yeah,
it's more boring than Waco. People retire from Waco where things are too crazy and they go to Abilene. Yeah,
I did not know that. I did not know there was a line.
Gotta get out of the big city.
but we lived in a lot of small places like that, but we also like we lived in Pakistan for a year, we lived in Alaska. We lived in Hawaii for a little bit. So it was cool. There was like some adventure. And then my dad retired in North Carolina. So I tell people I'm from North Carolina because I don't want to be that person who's like, well, actually, I. I'm just like, I'm from North Carolina, you know. But
how old are you when you finally settle in the States and stop moving around?
I was 14 when we moved to Rocky.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's, man, yeah, it's really both. I sympathize with your, like, where are you from being gray and then keeping it simple, because it's like before 14, there's so much memory time. That's a lot of remembering growing up, but also 14 to 18 is a lot of your childhood in a way.
Yeah.
It's so big.
And that's where I really do consider myself to be from North Carolina, and that like, that's where I became who I am. Like those years, especially staying there for college, between like 14 and 22, that's when you are concretizing, you know?
I like that word a lot. I don't know that I've heard of that recently. Concretizing is fucking great. Write that down. I have to ask then, is it just the sweet ass discount that sends you to School of the Arts, or were you looking at like leaving the neighborhood?
That's a good question. I wanted to go to NYU. I wanted to go to UCLA, to USC. I wanted that like Steven Spielberg fucking, either the LA Steven Spielberg, George Lucas thing, or the New York, like Jim Jarmusch, John Waters, avant-garde, whatever thing, you know?
Either?
One of the two. Those
are not fucking at all. You're like, I don't care if people are like shitting on each other in the woods, or if we're fighting aliens in space for $1 billion. Sign me up, baby.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, yeah, because they're completely different. And I think when I was a kid, I just wanted something that was like, I wanted to get out, and yeah, I wanted to go somewhere that I thought was going to be cool, for lack of a better word. That word means like nothing, but it means like everything when you're 15. And I wanted a pathway that I could like, I think that I could emulate, I guess, in a way. I can't explain it, because you're right. As soon as I said that, I was like, those are two completely different spaces. Like, why would I not have picked a side, you know?
Well, what they have in common is they are significant. They are assigned value by people across the field. Like even someone who makes a John Waters style movie, John Waters, I'm sure has a great opinion on Steven Spielberg. And I'm sure Steven Spielberg has a fucking great opinion on John Waters and Robert Rodriguez or Kevin Smith, or I mean, anybody who's making these movies that get everybody's attention and are inarguably a good movie, a good piece of film. Even if you have your style, I think you appreciate it across the board. And I think your mission is kind of clear, right? You just want to make something that was fucking good that everybody looks at and they're like, that's, I don't just want to, even if it's good because it's weird or it breaks the rules or whatever, that's not the point. It doesn't need to be good by any standards other than a lot of people are like, that's great.
Yeah. And that's, dude, it's so funny you say that, because I think that I don't know how you felt at this age. I think this is probably very, very common, but I was so insecure and I was so like pre-internet, really. I mean, not fully, but like we had just gotten MySpace, right?
Yeah,
like,
pre-socials in the way that they exist now.
Yeah, there was no connection outside of this town where there was very little, like, I mean, we live in a satellite town of Rocky Mount, which is like a city of like 60,000 people. I lived in a town of 5,000 people. And I'm like, there is no sounding board. There is no one to tell me I'm good, to tell me that which I desperately, desperately needed validation. And so I think I felt like I could get that at those places. Like that would, if I got in there, well, that means like, fuck all y'all, I'm out of here. I'm going to New York City. And, you know, like, shame on you for calling me a homo all those years for being in plays, because I'm out of here. And and they were used words that
I think you just plagiarized the fourth chapter of my autobiography. But yeah, that's that kind of rude. But you're right. You're right about it. No, that's totally true. I think that's a story that kind of concisely told. So many people are chasing that significance. And I can't relate to that more. That's all. I've said on this podcast before, I had a dream when I was like 17, still in high school, was like, I just want to get paid to hang out with famous people. I don't need to be friends. I don't need to be famous. I just want to be there. And I want that to be my job to some degree. Like, I'll do something while I'm there. I'm not just going to send my ass. But, like, can I just be at the fucking table? Not even looked at as if I belong there. But, like, well, we need Rob because he cleans up the shit when we're done or whatever. I don't know. Something.
Yeah.
I just want to be there because I feel like where I'm from, and it would take me so long until I grew up to realize all the value of where I'm from that I didn't recognize when I'm there. But that's being a fucking kid. I mean, you can't beat yourself up for that.
For sure.
But when you're growing up around stuff, you only appreciate so much what it's around you. What you really appreciate is what's not around you. You're like, how do I get that shit? Mm-hmm. I think I'm with you. I was chasing significance, even if it was aimless and unfocused. And when you look at School of the Arts, even though it's a conservatory, even though it's a very focused thing, you're like, but there is significance there.
Yes.
There is credibility. There is, look, they learned their thing and they went out and did those things. And I like those things. So fucking you teach me what you taught them and then I'm going to do shit and it's going to be good.
Yes. And that was the thing that I did discover. I mean, to bring it back to the school, I mean, that is what I discovered after going to like summer session there. I went there for film and that was like hugely eye-opening. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I don't have to. And I think that started a long period of conflict and like confusion around like, I can just be here. I don't have to be up here. I can just be at this other, not even other level. It's so weird how I segmented these things in my mind because NCSC is a fucking great school. It's a great school. Yeah. But I don't know. It wasn't in New York or LA. So I thought it was, but anyway, it started me on this journey of like, oh, okay, I don't have to play to these people and I don't have to be this person. And that was hugely, hugely eye-opening to me. And I'm really grateful for it now, but you know.
I want to ask you this question. This is my stopgap in between what I call Acts 1 and 3. You know, Act 1 is before you get to school. Act 2 is while you're there. We mostly skip it. And Act 3 is after that. Well, because it only really applies to people who were there when you were there. And other than that, any conversation we have about Act 2 is going to be like, oh, man, I worked on this film. And you have a great story about it, unless it really relates to something specific about what you learned, man, what are the odds it's going to be applicable to anybody? Mm-hmm. I don't think I talk about that a lot on this show. So anybody who's this deep into this episode, it's a little thing about how I think about this show. I skip back too because I just can't imagine we're going to hit that many things that are valuable to other people, as much fun as it might be for us. Mm-hmm. So to stopgap that though, so we don't totally skip what happened to you while you're at school, as far as your thoughts about work, creation, identity. When you enter school, you have a certain mentality that we kind of just covered about what that's going to do for you. Why bother? Why do it? It's going to propel me into places of significance, hopefully with the right skill set, so that I can grab a hold of some of that significance by making stuff that's good. And people mm-hmm. will look at me and be like, man, Graham is totally belongs to be here because he's fuck. Look at that thing he made. It's fucking great. That's the thing. You're there for 4 years. When you leave and you're holding the paper and you're headed to wherever it is you are actually headed to, how has your thoughts about that evolved? Do you feel like you got what you were trying to get? Did you get something totally different?
I got something totally different. I got something totally different.
What does that
and
mean?
And it's so interesting because like, I don't know how it is for people in other disciplines, but when you're coming out of film, the expectation is on you to generate your own shit. Like nobody's gonna, you have to make your own movie. And I did the thing that so many people do where I was, again, see, I was still obsessed with like New York or LA. I can't stay in North Carolina. I can't sit around in Winston-Salem. And the thing is like, you can, you just don't sit around. You can live there and make a bunch of cool shit.
Yeah.
And
for way, you know, fucking less money.
Right. I could have kept my part-time job at Ed McKay's, lived in a fucking house and made like weird independent horror movies and stuff in my backyard and probably made a little bit of money doing it back then. Cause you could still turn a profit on like homemade.
Graduated in 2009.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
So we're even talking pre removal of the tax incentive in North Carolina, if I remember correctly.
Because yes,
at some the tax incentive for filmmaking used to be massive. It's why your One Tree Hills, all your Wilmington-based shows were shot there. But then, for reasons that I cannot remember that made any sense, it expired. They didn't renew it, and everybody moved to fucking Atlanta, and it changed the landscape of East Coast shooting. Really, really did. So in 2009, there was actually still some time to you could work legit in North Carolina back then.
I could have gone to Wilmington. I could have stayed in Winston and been like a regional dude moving around. Or you know, again, I could have just started cranking little movies out. And back then too, that was a really interesting time because that was like, so I don't want to get too in the weeds for this is probably boring to a lot of people, but like it was pre-streaming. Yeah, you were still like, there was still money to be made for like, you could make a $15,000 horror movie that if it looked okay and it was smart and, you know, whatever, you could make a little bit of money off of that. You could get a distribution deal from DVD, whatever. And that is like just dead now. Like streaming has killed all that. There's no profit to be made on anything. So it was also this like kind of last.
I don't think that's boring for people, Graham. I think a bunch of people are out of work right now as we speak because of the shit that you just talked about that started back then. I think that is one of the, I remember when I was at school, so one of the film students told me, and I don't know if he got this from class or it was his thought or read in a book or whatever, but he was like, you really have to look at filmmaking, not television, filmmaking as venture capitalism. It's this huge investment hoping that when you're done with this thing that you have to pay for first, that you're going to be able to make your fucking money back. And it'd be really cool if you could make money. That's you need to have that mentality about every project that you do, because if you're really going to do it right and you're going to make sure that your writers are paid for, your actors are paid for, your directors are, everybody's being compensated fairly for real. That is not a cheap thing to do. And a movie is not an easy thing to make. So it shouldn't be fucking cheap either. So yeah. That, you know, and now we're at this impasse where they're like, it should be cheap. And it's like, but it fucking isn't, man.
Yeah. And if you are, for any like film students out there right now, it's like every single time you make a movie, even a short, you are essentially founding a small business for X amount of months. And that is really difficult for people like me whose brains don't lend themselves to that kind of activity.
Get a line producer.
Yes.
You have to have another person. And that's another thing that I was just talking to my wife about this. I'd be fascinated to hear what you think about this, because I think this gets us kind of into your act three as well, because you very much have, I've seen you work on all sorts of different things and I love that. I want to get into that, but here's the button on that small business venture capitalist concept. There are only so many versions of leadership that can exist, and I'm sure there's a great book where these all have titles that I haven't read, but this is purely from my like observation, and I've seen and been a part of every one of these things, and I'm sure you have too. So you have to have a creative visionary of some kind. You have to have the person who has the idea, and they are usually in the beginning, especially in the beginning, they're your leader. They're the president. They're your captain. They're not your co-captain. They're not your co-pilot. Unless it's a team, a partnership that's like really fucking tight. It's like one person. And that person then usually, because of their capacity, isn't also Elon Musk of the left and right brain, and needs a person who is their line producer, who is their stage manager, who is their assistant director, their first AD, someone who is balancing out their all their creative energy that's going to make this thing really fucking cool by making sure that everyone fucking shows up on time, that making sure that the lights stay on. These things fundamentally have to happen across the board, whether you're opening a gym or making a movie, and finding the right combination of those two people is a fucking nightmare. There's only so many ways it can work out. You hire another creative like you, and neither of you want to do the fucking work, but you're both excited about the project. That fucking collapses. Then you hire the person who's good at the clerical work, but doesn't really want to do it, and they kind of want to run the whole fucking thing, even though they're not creative. And you're like, but I have to run it, and you need to do the backup. And they're like, but I don't really like backup. And they're like, but that's why I asked you to be a part. That falls apart too. The only one that really works is where everybody knows their role, everybody is transparent, and everyone is participating with enthusiasm and saying, I can't wait for this thing to happen. And I know that in order for it to happen, the call sheet needs to go out. I'm really good at call sheets, and I'm going to send that call sheet every night with the passion of like, this movie's going to be great. Send. Uh-huh. Like, they need to have that feeling about that. And that's hard to find, because who's excited about doing the math?
I know. It's in the landscape of egos, the most difficult one to find is the one that is like, I am creatively minded and ambitious, but I also understand that that's not me, but I want to, but I have enough of a personality and an ego and a drive to make it happen with someone else in that role.
I always say, God bless the chief of staff.
Oh God. Yeah.
If you know anything about the executive branch of the US government and how the presidency really works, the chief of staff gets no credit, and they do everything, and they make sure that he doesn't fall down the steps so many fucking times.
Oh, poor Biden.
They're so hard to find.
Yeah.
They're so hard to find, because who wants to work that hard on the not fun stuff?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Like, nobody. And when you find that person, you pay them double. For real. For real. You have to. You have to make sure that they get a piece of the thing. Because you people like you and I, Graham, we can't do anything without them. Am I wrong? Mm-hmm.
100% true. And I learned that the hard way. The thing you described of like having like just two creatives, it falls apart every time, like you said.
Yeah. And it breaks your heart, because you usually pick that person because you're so fucking both in love with the thing.
Yeah.
We both love the thing so much. We want to make the thing work so bad. And then before you know it, you're like, we need a third person. Because we're just both very excited about doing all the stuff on the right side of the room. And no one's touched the mess on the left side of the room. Like, that's kind of why there's two of us. But we've both been hanging out over here. We're like, I guess we got to get somebody in here to do the left side stuff.
Yeah, you can't what both be scared. You can't both be scared to open the mail, you know? Like, you got to...
That is great. Is that all you? Because that's a great line. You can't both be scared to open the mail.
That is me, I believe. Yeah, that's me.
Write it down, folks. No, I always just try to clock it, because when I find really good sentiments, you never know if it's something they're like granddad told them like 30 years ago, and you're like, that's fucking good, but we got to give granddad the shout out. But if it's you, write it down and sell a t-shirt, because man, that's fucking really good.
Oh, thank you. Well, my wife and I both have anxiety around the me especially, but we're both like, is it good today? Is it bad today? And one of us just has to push through and open that mailbox up, you know, and like get in there. So it's tough.
I can imagine both of you standing there with this kind of like half energy of like, I'm going to do it. Shut up.
Yeah, you know Joella.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, you know her well.
And you know my wife Candace, because I started also dating her when we lived together.
I do. I love her, man. She's great. She's the best. I was so happy to see that, like, you know, blossom from a distance, you know, to keep growing. Yeah.
Same. I think that, okay, so let's kind of take one thing at a time, because I want to make sure we cover the many different things that I've kind of seen you do from a distance, and then I'm sure there's plenty of other stuff. Let's start with the horror stuff in general. You love, you already mentioned kind of as your example of an independent filmmaker, you know, horror would be like was your genre of example. I don't think that's like a crazy accident. You love it. You strike me also with that kind of so popular now, which I guess, I don't know, to your benefit, or probably I'm going to say law of abundance to your benefit. There are these like Krasinski, Peele. There are these people who have a very lighthearted comedic personality. Performance wise, they really soar with being funny. They're really fucking funny, but their minds are also deeply tied to and show aptitude with horror and shock and gore and things that are often not present in comedic work at all. I think you definitely are like in that family of, you know, you have dinner with you and your wife, and I wouldn't jump to horror filmmaker. because there's stereotypes, I think, for the longest time about what that person even looked like or was like.
Yeah. I'm not like, I don't have like a chain wallet and like a Charles Manson t-shirt. So
Right.
people,
Well, I
yeah.
think so many people think like Tim Burton or like Rob Zombie or like these like look creepy looking dudes are the ones behind all of the horror, but it's like, you know who also was a creepy dude? Vincent Price. And he was like kind of a normal little guy. Like
That's the best that's a price impression I've ever
there was a guy at School of the Arts who was a guest artist for many years, and then he left and he director, and he came back while I was there in the directing program, and I ended up mentoring him over the summer and during the school year like three or four times. He mentored me, I should say, and he did the best Vincent Price impression as himself because that's what he sounded like. And I used to do a John Dylan impression for years, and I finally realized I was like, oh, I think I'm accidentally doing the best Vincent Price ever because that's what John Dylan said. Okay, everybody, like, let's go. And and as long as you have a little bounce in your shoulders, you know, it is but it goes to my point of like, I think that especially in our lifetime, when we were growing up as kids, I didn't, there weren't a lot of like John Krasinski's, Jordan Peele. There weren't people who had your temperament and vibe who were making a name for themselves in horror.
Yeah.
But there is an attraction to that now.
I think like when I was a kid, I actually didn't watch a ton of, I mean, I think that experience that everybody has with the genre that is like, or everyone who likes kind of falls in love with it has where you go to the Blockbuster and you get that thing that you know you're not supposed to have, and you watch it all by yourself or with your friend at like midnight, and your parents don't know that it's rated R, you know, that kind of an experience. And so I wouldn't say that I was like consumed by the genre like when I was a kid, but I was always drawn to stuff that was transgressive or provocative or like boundary pushing in some way. And if it was like basically if it was Oklahoma, like I'm not interested in this shit, I don't have time for this, like this doesn't move my needle. So I was always kind of looking for that, and that is I guess probably most prevalent in that genre.
Do you have
So
any concept of why this is gonna, I'm gonna say it the way I was gonna say it, but know that I know how it sounds. Do you have any concept of why you're like that?
I think if I had to
Why isn't
guess,
Oklahoma fucking good enough for you, Graham?
why are you such a pretentious creep? I think, it came from, I think, coming up in like a very conservative community, being one, the military, starting with
Right,
that, right?
sure.
Where
Very traditional.
it's not the small town Southern Baptist that I moved to, but it is still a very like regimented, hierarchical, structural, governmental, whatever system.
Rules, 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 rules.
Yeah. And then I had a mom who is, and my dad's great. I love him. We get along better now than ever. You know, he was kind of an authoritarian when I was a kid, and now we're cool, which is great.
I've heard military dads are like that. My granddad was like that with my dad, and it kind of freaked him out. He got older and he was like, why is everything like, all right.
Yeah, why are we cool now? Why can I cuss in front of you now? But my mom was always like finding, you know, I don't know if weird is the right word, but like she would give me like poetry and Jack Kerouac and this, like she has a real literary bent, and she was very like socially very liberal. And
What'd she
so
do?
she was a teacher for a long time. Now she actually writes, she's a very prominent writer in the 50 Shades of Grey fan fiction community.
What?
Yeah, that's a thing. She's
Give me
like
a
friends
second
with
to
E.L.
unpack.
James.
So a very prominent, so this is a huge community, and in this community of people who write not canon 50 Shades stories, she's prominent. She's like a big deal over there. She's one of
Yes,
the best.
Yeah, like she has she's had lunch with the woman who created the thing, who wrote the franchise. And oh, this is actually, sorry, total side note here, but I
Dude,
think
I
this
didn't know
actually
that. That's so
probably
funny to me.
this probably is the best example of like why I am the way I am. Which
Because
is
now your mom's famous for like writing about people fucking.
yeah. Well, and do you know the woman? Did you
You're
watch
like Chandler Bing in real life.
I forgot about that. That's right. His mom's
His
like,
mom is Morgan Fairchild, and she's like she's like an adult novelist. That's so funny.
yes. Oh my God. Yeah.
We
Gosh.
forget those people are there, and we shouldn't continue.
But have you seen Boy Meets World? You've seen Boy Meets World.
Sure.
You know the one who the redhead who grew up and now she's doing porn and stuff?
Maitland Ward.
Yes.
Yeah.
She's a friend of my mom's through this community. So I've met her because my mom came to New York to hang out with Maitland Ward. And I like sat at the bar while they had coffee. And then my dad and I like met her. And I have pictures of this woman now. So that like having that kind of, and by the way, this was not like something that was, it's not like my mom was talking about this
It
stuff.
wasn't present when you were a kid at all, because that movie
No, and
wasn't
I don't
even
know what
out.
the hell's going on behind closed doors. I don't want to know.
Of
I don't ask. I don't read
course.
her work.
Right.
But she's
You
obviously.
don't read her work, Graham? Shocking. There's your horror movie.
Joellen has, and she says it's good. And I'm like, that's great. That's all I need to know. And then, yeah, there's my horror movie. You're right.
It really
But
it's not it really isn't a horror movie, but it very much is like a rom-com thing. That is like is that not totally a trope that would be like Matthew McConaughey finds out that his mom at like 60 years old is like, what do you mean? You can't be writing
yes.
about that stuff. Get out of here. Like
Well, and there was a period where like I hadn't had anything published in a long time and I wasn't doing anything. This is true. There was a period of time where I was like, my mom is succeeding at this and I'm not, like, what the fuck? There was a weird like
sure.
internal conflict of like, what am I doing? And
So
that's a movie.
you tried your hand at 50 Shades fan fiction because clearly genetically there's an aptitude that, or am I giving you this idea? Cram, catch up.
But no, I think so. Clearly, she's like a very free-spirited person, right? And so that's where I think having that I was always sort of in this position of like, fuck you, I'm not gonna play to this, whatever rule it was, I was upset over it, whatever authority figure was in front of me, I was upset about it.
We're not
And
going
so
to take
that,
it.
yeah, I wanted to always,
Whatever it is, not
yes.
fucking taking it. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
100%.
So that makes a lot of sense to me in the horror world. And I saw pieces of you working on different things when we lived together. Things that you were working on with Joe, and I was in a thing once, right? Didn't we do a thing where we shot it at the apartment?
It was Neckbeard for the Neckening. You were very
I
funny
didn't
in
even
that.
get it. I didn't even like when you explained the whole thing to me, like, no, it's this kind of meme where they have the thing with the hat. And I was like, I don't, what do you need me to do? And they're like, we just hold this bong and be frustrated with your roommates. And I was like, yeah, I know how to do that. I
You're like, you mean,
practice.
oh, is it 2 p.m. on a Tuesday? Like, yeah, I can do
Yeah,
this.
I'll rehearse it every day until we shoot. Gotcha.
Can be mad at them.
Oh shit, that's so funny. But let's say we, because I know we only have so much time, but let's talk about this country music thing, man.
Oh yeah, that was like a COVID thing where I was like, and that was COVID. I don't know how you dealt with this, but that was a big turning point for me creatively in general, because like all of a sudden movies weren't happening and couldn't happen. And so I started to explore this other stuff and I was like, oh, I really like this. And weirdly, sorry, am I being too like off course? I'm like,
No.
going off on. So I think that was like this eye-opening moment of like, I've been really trying to go into the front door of Hollywood. And I was like, I'm going to be the screenwriter and I'm going to do what they need me to do. You know, right. I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to write
the next significance, baby.
Yes. Yeah. That validation. I'm going to write the next Annabelle movie. And then everyone will be like, oh, you're, you know, whatever.
There he is. There he is. We found him. Guys, he's here.
Well, you know, funny, you say that. My mentor at NCSA, Wayne Crawford, used to tell me, he's like, never quit, because eventually they're going to turn around and need someone and you'll be the only one left. Mm. And I'm like, backhanded, great advice.
Like, hey, I know you're going to want to quit, but even if you sink to the bottom of the barrel, stay down there, baby, because they got to scrape that bitch out one day.
Yeah.
And then when they do and they're about to throw it in the garbage, you're going to be like, hey, look at this guy. Boom.
Yeah.
That is such a weird compliment. It is good advice, though.
It is good, but it wasn't like, never give up because you're so smart. It's like, never give up because one day, you know, you'll just have held on longer.
It'll be you.
So I started to explore other stuff just because I constantly have to be like generating something. Right. And for good and for bad. And that's when I started taking guitar lessons and I just started writing these like dirty country songs. And I put them on Instagram and I met this guy who was into similar stuff and he runs a small like indie comedy label. And I ended up like recording an album during quarantine and putting it out with Half Cashed Bowl Records is the name of the company.
Half Cashed Bowl.
Yeah.
That sounds like a drug reference. I love it.
I think it might be. And the album is called Truckin' and Cuckin'. And I put out some other stuff with him too, but yeah.
So what are you still, is that something you're still pushing on, still working on? Or is it just, is that was a quarantine thing, one and done?
I'm still doing it. I've fallen away from it a little bit because I get distracted and I have trouble focusing on one thing for very long.
Sure, but, I can relate.
But I have another song coming out here soon, like a single from them. So it's like in fits and starts, still ongoing.
Right.
Yeah.
Also tell me a little bit about the journey, because like you moved out in 2018.
Yeah.
Something like that, 2018. And but you moved to another place in LA, but you don't live in LA anymore.
No, we're in New York now. We moved after we left Silver Lake with you guys. We moved to Mar Vista.
Okay.
And we got married there. And then from there, COVID hit like almost right after, like a few months after. And then, yeah, I think we just got really stir crazy, you know, stuck in this apartment and feeling a little stuck in LA. Because again, you know, the movie stuff had kind of, I'm like, what am I doing?
Yeah, what are we doing?
Pursuing? And that city is such a place where like, if you're not doing the thing, you're like, what? Well, at least for me, I was like, if I'm not doing or at least pursuing the thing, what am I doing here? Because, you know, I know people naturally love LA, but how do you feel? I mean, you're
how
like,
do I feel about still living here?
Yeah.
I feel like, I totally get what you're talking about. I think any city that is this expensive to live in, let's just keep it super simple and talk about how fucking much money it costs. Yeah. We've lived all over the country. We're very aware of what this much money is going to get you in a different place. That sucks because you spend a lot of time being like, ugh, why are we here? But when you live in one of the most expensive places in the world, if you live in London, if you live in New York, if you live in LA, San Francisco, you're paying extra to be near those things.
Yeah.
That's how it works. This is simple. That's how, and this is going to sound super condescending, and I really don't mean it this way, but that's how property value works. That's just how it works. We pay for what we're near. Right. Because it costs money to get nearer to things. Super simple. I don't resent the fact that it is expensive to live near these things that don't exist anywhere else in the world. Hollywood, love it or hate it, both. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. Most of us, both. It's not anywhere else, bitch. It just ain't nowhere else. It just isn't. And whether it's on or off or striking or working or whatever the fuck is going on, just, and this is what COVID maybe taught me more than anything. Even when I was like, maybe Hollywood's got naive, and we all deserve to be because we didn't know any fucking better. But yeah. I was watching, like, especially because I was running a comedy club during the pandemic.
That's right. Oh, my God.
So I'm literally watching Joe Rogan move to Austin. Tom Segura and Christina P move to Austin. Not just move, bring their empires that they've built over here. Invest in the local economy. The mothership, the new club that Joe runs is open there now. It looks like the coolest fucking thing ever. But I was watching that happen and I'm like, man, this might be, maybe we have finally a Hollywood 2. That's not Atlanta. Uh-huh. It's a very different kind of thing where not just we make things, but then we fly back to LA. Maybe the celebrities, the famous people who bring the cachet of Hollywood, that brings the money. Cachet brings the money. And if they bring the cachet, it's always been Austin. I grew up there. It's always been a town that people are like, we're the next Hollywood. We're the next this. We're going to build a movie studio. We're going to be the comedy capital. We're going to be the this. And they never fucking happened. I watched it happen for 25 years while I lived there. They never did it. They never became anything other than the live music capital. It's like their thing. And they have some competition with like Nashville anyway. So really, this was like, oh shit, the most famous comedian and podcaster in the world isn't just buying a house here. He is moving his life here. He is moving his work here. That's a big fucking deal. And he's not coming by himself. And so I really thought the second wave was going to happen and it didn't. It's this tiny little extra blip that's over there now. And it's cool, but it's very stand-up focused. It's very podcast focused. Like James Vanderbeek, someone that I worked with once, who I like kept in touch with after we worked together. Super fucking nice guy. Love him.
That's awesome.
He lives there. He doesn't exactly produce the volume that he used to. So it's like people like that are retiring there. Like they, mm-hmm. That's cool, but it's not ever going to be Hollywood. Nothing else ever is. And I think COVID taught me that more than anything. And so if I want to be around the kind of stuff that I want to be around, just to be around, I like to be around it. I like it. I like to know that it's happening around me. You know, I see a premiere for a movie that I think is really cool. And it's like fucking 10 minutes from my house. Like knowing that is cool to me still after all this time. When that wears off, it won't be worth paying for. That's definitely not what I'm paying for. But the other thing that's big to me, dude, and this is different. My wife's whole family lives here.
Oh, all of them. That's huge.
Like mom, dad, brother, cousins, uncles, everybody is LA. She has a few people like as other places, but not like my situation where they're kind of scattered and a little bit in Texas. It's like, no, they're all available for dinner next week.
Yeah, that's huge. Especially as we get older and, you know, we get married and we, you know, do these things.
Well, they're conservative Korean traditional people, man. They want to, the hand gestures, they want to meet. They want to be together. My family is very like, once you're an adult, you're welcome to go do your own thing. You don't owe us anything. And they're very much like, you're never out of the club. Where are you? It's dinner time.
Is that a white people thing? Where, because my parents are that way too. Everybody I know, it's like, well, not everybody, most of the white people I know, their parents are like, I don't know. They live in fucking 5,000 miles away and they get together once a year and it's fine. You know,
I think it varies, but I think it is more specific to certain cultures. Gravity is stronger typically, but it could be all over the place. You know, I've got my roommate, Kyle, who actually replaced Joe, like took his room. I still live with him. He lives with me and my wife and his family lives in Idaho, like in the woods. And like mom and dad live upstairs in this big house that has multi-levels. And the kids live down, like they live in the same house together.
Wow. Like
India style. And cool. I think they have their own issues with that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but that is how they're living. And with my wife, it's with the Korean culture, and I think it's also part of it is Korean, but also part of it is the immigrant culture. It's like, we came over from here. We now live in this area. I want to see you. I only have so many family members, extended family members. It's finite. Mm-hmm. And so you should be at dinner because it's his birthday and we all, what's up with you?
Like, no, I love that. And that's part and that's of something. It. Yeah, and that's something I took for granted too. And honestly, I mean, moving back to the East Coast too, I'm not near them, you know, being in New York, but like I'm a hell of a lot closer. Yeah. And that's been a good thing. So
where's Joellen from?
She's from Pennsylvania. So that's the other thing
too.
Oh,
you're like, even closer to her family.
We're super close. We're like 90 minutes from her parents. So that's
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
good. Awesome. We kind of glazed over it when we exchanged like emails and texts and stuff we were talking before, but I know you mentioned that during all of this change and stuff like that, you've kind of had a tough time processing everything, and it seems like you're doing really great. What happened for you that got you from not so great to better?
Yeah. So I don't want to talk about that anymore, Rob.
Okay. No, I really appreciate stopping by, man, and note taken. Awkward, but note taken.
Click. No. I think it happened. So I'd always been dealing with, I mean, even back at school, I remember this, right? Like this issues with depression, basically. Mm. Like garden variety depression, not anything like, you know, I don't know what the word is. Extreme or intense, I guess, compared to what other people have to wrestle with, you know, but it had been this constant issue that I did that thing. I think a lot of people do. Well, some people do this where I thought like, one, I didn't think it was that big a deal. Right. And I was like, well, that's just how I am. Other people in my family are like this. It's just what we deal with. It's a family thing, whatever.
Sure. And cross the bear, so to speak.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And I also thought perversely, like this helps me creatively. Like I see things differently or like whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or, like, I process things differently and then I create stuff to deal with this issue. And so I think that's what it was. I think I got wrapped up in this idea that like I was creating stuff to deal with the issue. So if I fixed the or tried or whatever to alleviate the problem, then I wouldn't make anything anymore. Or
it wouldn't. There's an old Patton Oswalt bit that I love where he says, no one wants to listen to a happy comedian. It's a funny bit, but is a toxic thought. And he makes the joke of like, there's no material in that. Like, have you ever met somebody and they're just your other half? Anybody? Am I right? Like, that's not a joke. Like,
right.
Oh, is it, well, what if you ever meet someone and it feels like they're just made out of fucking puppy kisses? Can I get a no? Like, it just, that's a dead air. And there's something at what he's talking about. And I also think I want to point out culturally for you and I, we grew up with older siblings, either literal or in culture, who were Gen Xers, who could not have tried harder to make apathy look fucking cool and necessary to success. If you cared too much, you're like gay or something. I don't know.
Yes.
For real.
Yeah.
And so it's like when we were like, I'm excited to do a thing, it would be like, calm down there, Sparky. Let's like bring it down to fucking Danny Masterson on 70s show vibes here and not give a fuck. And it sounds cool on TV, but man, it gets into your head. And I think I think that's also part of what's at play of not addressing it.
Yes. Yes. It's like, it's not cool to care. It's not cool to be enthusiastic. And the thing too, is like, I used to, well, basically I've gone through some talk therapy. I'm medicated now, all that stuff. So, you know, I would feed on the extremity of my feeling. So like talking about it, like, is it cool to be passionate or cool to care? It's like when I did, I didn't care. And it was very freeing because I was so extreme in my feeling. And the positivity was so great and so strong, and everything was so good. And this was going to be this big project or this big thing. And now that I've evened out a little bit, it's been better. Like I create more, I focus more, I see things through, because I'm not stopping myself and doubting myself and saying, oh, this is so great. No, it's not. It's trash. Throw it away. But I didn't do anything to fix it until it got really, really bad. And I think,
how did you know it was time?
I was having some extremely dark ideation around, like, I was dealing with some suicidal ideation, basically. And that was something that, like, you know, it kind of backburnered that, like, through little periods throughout my life. But I moved to New York, and I don't think it was because of New York. I think it was a lot of things, but it went from being the back burner to being like, we're starting a grease fire here, and I'm not going to be able to put it out. And so by the time I went, and if anyone's listening to this and going down a similar path, like, I wish that I had been like, oh, you're an idiot. This has nothing to do with your creativity. This has everything to do with you maintaining, like, a functional life and taking care of it earlier. Because by the time I went, I don't know if you've gone through this. I think you're more stable than this. But I by the time I talked to somebody, like a psychiatrist, there was no, like, let's think about medication. Let's go to talk therapy. Let's start this out. It was like, I'm giving you the prescription now. You're going to fill it today. And I'm going to check in with you next week, like, or within 48 hours or something. It was very intense. Not like we're calling someone to come get you, but like,
how did that make you feel when you had felt differently the day before you went in? Like, how was that an adjustment to the way you felt to hear that severity?
It was a mix of, actually, honestly, I think it was relief, because it was somebody saying, man, it's interesting. It's so interesting you ask that, because I've never really considered it. I think it was a feeling of relief, because, and I think that you and I relate on this in a lot of ways, in that, like, we're from kind of old school Southern families where you deal with issues by internalizing them to a degree. Life, I remember my there's a saying, and this is common, it's not a my family thing, but like, start wishing in one hand and shitting in the other and see which fills up first. You know, like, you don't get what you want. Life is hard. It is what it is. Suck it up and go to work.
And you, like, you get and you don't throw a fit.
Yes. Yeah.
That's my favorite Southern one. It's
it's great.
It's meant to keep kids from being greedy. But if you keep saying it to adults, it's just straight up discouragement.
yeah.
Like, when when it's a child that's not responsible for themselves, you're like, hey, you need to kind of play the cards you're dealt here. But if you get older and you say that same concept to someone over and over again, you're really telling them, like, you're never getting any better cards ever. So stop. I don't give up or whatever, but please stop complaining. And it's like, man, you're like, that's not support. Why are you so desperate and sad that you can't even offer me support in a time when I'm literally not sure if I could keep doing this shit? That's all in your head.
Man. Yeah, that's very, that's really true. And I don't think I'd really considered it that way, because I even now I still romanticize that mentality to a degree. But that did start to, basically, to answer your question quickly. Sorry, I know I've been talking for a long time.
Oh, it's okay, buddy. You don't worry about that.
It was, I think, a feeling of relief, because it was somebody saying, like, I recognize that. And not that I have people in my life who are very supportive and extremely, you know, but a medical professional saying, like, this is real, this is legitimate, and I'm going to help you. And at that time, that was a big deal.
And so how long ago was that?
That was about a little over a year and a half ago, I think. Close to 2 years ago, I think.
What are the non-creative ways in which your life is different?
I don't hate myself as much, honestly. My inner monologue has shifted, to the point
So
where,
powerful.
yeah, I don't, I try to celebrate achievements. I try to not think, well, yeah, but you could have done it better. I don't tell myself I'm a loser all the time, which was like, dude, constant. It was constant. I
Again,
really.
going back to the cultural thing, that was literally like Beck's number one hit for the Gen Xers. I'm not joking. They celebrated it. They're like, I'm a fucking loser and nothing matters. And you're like, yeah, that's cool for like one character on a sitcom that everybody makes fun of. That's not a way to live your fucking life. That's so depressing. But it was
It's
it.
very.
There's only a there's so much responsibility to the culture that you grow up in, and then what you do to process it. And some of it is family. We put a lot of it on family. You go to therapy. A lot of therapists are going to talk to you about your family. But your culture, your friends at school, your films, your television, your music, these things too. I mean, we grew up in the transition from like fucking Gen X grunge and Nirvana and literally all of their fucking like lead singers killing themselves, Sublime, all these fucking like they're all sad and we all celebrate the shit out of their music and how sad it fucking was. And then that just like became a quick blip of Blink-182, Sum 41, let's party in the summer. And then boom, emo shows up as a response to that to say, don't forget to be sad, motherfucker. Remember your older brother and how sad he was? Don't give up on that shit. You're about to have a party in the summer with the girl from the rock show, and you need to remember the Black Parade, motherfucker, because it's dark in this life. It's like a fucking man, that was a tough time to be a teenager and come out with it with a healthy attitude.
Oh my God. Yeah. I think like so many people that I admired too. It's funny you say that. Like, I think so many artists that I looked up to were alcoholics, were addicts, were
Especially writers, you have a
suicidal.
great taste in poets and literary figures and all that shit. You like actually read books, and
Oh, there's
all the
no more
famous
self
authors.
there's no more self-destructive group, yeah, to like look up to. And yeah, so I mean, I think like and it's such a weird place to be where you're constantly there's this constant internal push and pull of like I'm where you have this massive ego, right? We all do because we're like what I have something of value and I'm an artist and I'm a creator and I'm gonna blah 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 whatever. And then the other half of you is like, you're a loser. You can't even work in a gas station because you're so incompetent. You're a fucking idiot. And to top it off, you're mean and rude and people don't like you, you know? And it's just like
And you're like, that last few things does feel true based on the way you're talking to me now.
everyone listening to this is like, yeah. Self-perception. Wow.
Well, and you know, I also think it's too, you know, I clearly you're someone who sees a lot of value in comedy. You see a lot of value in developing the skill set of making people laugh. And that whole world is drenched in, and I'm not even getting into mental health issues with comedians. That's not even the thing I want to bring up. That's not my point right now. I want to make that clear. But I do want to point out that especially like a lot of British humor, a lot of pockets of humor are based on self-deprecation. And it starts to feel like if you really think too much of yourself, you might lose your sense of humor because the people who think they're great are the ones we make fun of. They're not funny.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. 100%.
And so your brain is like, well, I care more about being funny than maybe anything else, because that seems to be the thing people find the most value in me. Because hell, even if I'm a fucking loser, at least I make people laugh at dinner, you know? Like, and you
Dude.
get in your head about that, and you're like, I remember the other thing. I just processed this, dude, and I'm sure you dealt with the same shit. I thought really about how supportive my parents were growing up, because I've always been grateful for that. I've never been unaware of it. I know a lot of other people I've struggled with that. And I have areas like when I want to go to school of the arts and borrow a bunch of money from the government on an arts degree and not have the full support of my parents. But like there for the most part, when I was like, I just want to find something that makes me happy, they were like, do it, kid. Don't get trapped in jobs you don't like. You like
Awesome.
keep going after your shit. Yeah, it's really good. But there was one super unhelpful thing that happened, especially on my dad's side of the family. And it, my dad was super guilty of doing it to me. And it's not his fault because everybody taught him this. You're kind of never allowed to even verbalize your own accomplishments or achievements ever. It is like, sit down, be humble, impress everybody, do amazing shit, be the best. And never acknowledge it. I mean, to yourself. Don't get in your own head. And I remember when I was a kid, I would get compliments on projects, or I was funny in a school play, or I did a thing. And they'd be like, yeah, you're so good. You're so talented. You're so funny. You're so smart. You're so cute. And all these compliments. Boom, 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 boom. And I'm like, wow, I am? And they're like, calm down. And I'm like, but you just fucking said I'm all these things. And they're like, you are. And I'm like, I'm cute. And they're like, you need to cool it, man. Stop saying shit like that. And I'm so confused. And I think that that is a really, really big part of, and I've only recently kind of figured out that that was at play. And so I grew up with this twisted, like rebellious arrogance of like, fuck my parents telling me not to like myself. They're telling me I'm great. I'm going to believe them. A weird argument to have in your own head. But then it came off as like almost false confidence. And I spent my early 20s, I think mostly, and maybe into my mid 20s, kind of trying to meld real legitimate confidence based in what I'd done or what I could do or what I thought had value in me for real and authentic way with what I'd been pretending to be for a very long time.
That's so interesting, man, and deeply relatable because this chair is very squeaky. I hope it doesn't ruin the recording.
I can barely hear it.
Oh, good. Okay. But it's like when you're young, going to school, coming out of school, any school like ours, but or if you don't or can't or whatever, go to school, whatever. When you're a young artist, I feel like it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all false confidence. It's because it's like you're imagining that you can be this thing that is hard to do and scary and weird and different. And so I totally remember feeling like it's all fake. It's all fake, but it has to exist or you won't be able to. I remember talking to, do you remember EJ Cantu?
Yeah. Yeah. EJ Cantu. I'm thinking of EG Garcia. EJ Cantu, yes, film school. Got it.
Yeah, I went to high school with that dude. I've known him a long time.
I didn't know that.
So I don't think he would. I'm not saying anything bad about him. I don't think he would mind me saying this, but I had this conversation with him when we were real young. We were like teenagers. And he was talking about auditioning for stuff, like for school and for local plays and things like that. And he was like, when I go in there, I know I'm going to get it. And the thing is, he was right. He was like incredibly talented. He is incredibly talented. And I was like, that's kind of arrogant, man. You know, I was like very judgy of him, you know?
Yeah.
Because at the same time I was like telling myself the opposite, you know? So I hated that he was able to feel this way too, you know?
Right.
And he was like, well, if I don't feel that way, then why am I going in? Like, dude, there's no reason to do it if you're not, that's the only way it's going to happen. And it's so true, man. Like this 19-year-old kid, like knew this intangible thing that it's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that that's something that I definitely, and I have talked to Brandon about this before on the show. It's a personal journey for me. And I wish everybody luck on their journey because I don't know what everybody's path to this is, but I think it's so important. You have to believe in what you're doing. And I don't care if you're an artist or not. Like, you have to believe in what you're doing. You shouldn't be doing stuff you don't believe in at all, ever, any of it. Like, I think that's dumb. And if you can, if you can afford to live and not do anything that you don't believe in, do that. You know, life, and especially in this country, doesn't always make that easy. Sometimes we can't afford to make that choice. And I want to make that clear. That's why I leave that caveat. But no, I just talked to somebody else about this. Sierra Payton was here.
I love her, dude. She's so cool, she's man. The best.
And I was just talking to her yesterday and we agreed. It's just like, just don't. Like, if you don't agree with it, if you don't believe in it for real and you can afford to make that choice, it shouldn't even be a choice. And I think that that's a problem that we have all the time, is because we let other people tell us that something is important, or we let other people tell us that something has should have value to us, or we should care about a thing and be open to that. Hear people out. I'm not saying, like, I don't want to cancel every political movement in the world at the same time. I get the idea of trying to, you know, the missionary approach, but at the same time, if you don't really believe in what you're doing, I don't think you should do it. So if your problem is that you don't believe in it because of shit that is in the way in your own head, despite the fact that maybe evidence suggests there's all the reasons to believe in it, that's work to do. There's nothing wrong with doing that work. There's nothing wrong with admitting that that work is to be done. I chose a kind of fake it till you make it approach, which is only so helpful for so long. And then you have to kind of stop doing that shit. But in the beginning, that's a kind of way to kickstart it. Just pretend you're as cool and capable of shit as you think you are for a while. Act that role out so you see what it's like, and try to bring as much of your authentic self to that as you possibly can.
Yeah.
Just pretend that you believe in yourself. But if that starts to feel like a hollow mask behind which you do not at all believe in yourself for real, and it's just fake every day, well, then you need to reassess.
Yeah, dude.
There's 100%. A lot of paths to it.
Yeah. And that was something that, like, hugely, I mean, bringing this up to like where I'm at now, he said self-obsessively.
Episode is about you. You're in the title. It's okay.
But I'm such a piece of shit, Rob.
Right, right.
No, I'm kidding. But
I can back song start in my head.
I just had my first novel come out, which I also want to plug. But that only happened because I did take a step back from, like, I'm going to be the Annabelle guy, to asking, like, do I believe in this, or am I doing this because, yeah, you really do enjoy those movies. You like eating the popcorn. You want to be in the WGA and you want the health insurance and you want the cool LA house. Or is it because you really, 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 this is in your bones, you know, and in your blood. And so I took a step back to kind of try to find out what that, if that was true or not. And I don't think it is, because I started doing other shit and it worked. So
it doesn't, in my opinion, and I don't want to wreck any progress that you're making on this, but I think it's about opening up to the long game of it all and accepting that that thing you just described that you do want may not be completely out of the cards for you, but it's not the only cards. And there's so many other cards and things to do. And they, other things that you may focus on, may end up being the path to that thing in some kind of weird way around the bend that you never thought about. And if anybody's listening to this show this deep into the episode, you already fucking know. That is the story of people that go to this school. Whether they are getting that thing they wanted that when they were 17 and started in the fall, whether that shows up for them in the way they think or not, which it almost never does, even when it does, it's not what the fuck you thought it was going to be, dude. It just isn't. It doesn't go the way you thought it was. Now all of a sudden it's weird every time you talk to all these people you knew in the spring that were your best friends, but you can't even talk to them because every time they talk to you as the person who got that job, and you're that forever. That's not nothing to deal with. That is not like what you thought was going to happen. It never is. And I think that that is the lesson of this, is being open to, it's okay to not know. You need a little bit more zen, a little bit more go with the flow, while keeping that hardworking ethic and accepting, dude, I've almost made 100 episodes of this fucking TV show I work on right now.
That's amazing, dude. Congratulations.
Thank you. If you had told me 10 years ago, 5 years ago, this is going to be the show that you end up, like, really make, and I've got a very hands-on, I make the shit out of the show, not alone with a wonderful team, but a very small team. We make it together. And I don't even know if I would have been excited. It might have bummed me out to tell me that this was the thing I was going to do, because I had completely ignorant and naive perspective on it. I just didn't know what the fuck that meant. It would have sounded dumb. And I love what I'm doing. I don't want to do it forever, but I do know this: everything I want to do later, this is helping. In like a bunch of ways. And I know you're in the same space, which is like, dude, even if you end up going back to write and put yourself to the grindstone of doing the Annabelle move, do any, whatever your thing ends up being in that realm, even the fucking country music guy you made up is going to be a part of what informs the work that you do over there. Like, it is all connected in our head as artists. You're drawing from all the water lilies, Monet, always. For real.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
So I'm very, man, I feel great catching up with you just to hear where you're at, because it's a gamble, if I'm being honest, doing this show and like on air being like, how's it been going? That can go any number of ways. And I'm always so warm in my heart to hear that my friends are doing very well up here and in here, which is the thing that, like I said, it's the only thing I really care about, man. A resume is your business, and Seth Meyers or whoever the fuck you end up talking to about it. But I'm far more interested in all the stuff that we talked about. Thank you for your candidness and vulnerability. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, man. And yeah, thank you for having me. And I love this show. And I think, again, I think that, like, if I had been a student at the time, this would have been so helpful to me. So I just wanted to lay as much out as I could.
Thank you. Plug the book. But I don't think we got the title and the availability.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. It's called Rock City. It's actually about, very loosely, it's a highly fictionalized version of some of my experiences, like in Rocky Mount in North Carolina, growing up there. Again, very, very, very mostly fictional. Sure. But you'll recognize some of the places if you've been there. But yeah, it's called Rock City. It came out from Broken River Books like a month ago, I think.
Nice.
And you can get it on Amazon. I would go there.
Have you laid down the audiobook yet?
No.
Ooh, can I ask you an honest question? Would you do it, or would you hire somebody that you really like their voice, like some actor friend of yours who you're like, they're fucking cool, I like them?
I don't know.
Would you do it? You have a great voice. I would totally listen to you read me a book.
Oh, thanks. Then I might. with that endorsement, yeah, I might.
I just always think it's a great addition. I know it's super time consuming, and to really do it right, it's not cheap usually, and all that, but I know it goes a really long way towards, man, there's some of us, I'm a big audiobook guy in particular, because I have trouble with the way my ADD works and some of my processing, that I don't do well on long texts. I lose track, I get distracted, it kind of goes off. So if I can get it almost in podcast form, that's like the easiest way for me to digest it. So I always root for that, especially with, you know, young writers, if you can, because it is, it goes a long way to getting that to a lot more people. And I think especially now, dude, we're such a listening society and culture, so much more. And I it sucks, because, man, I really want to write a book about this. I really think that I'm going to write a book about At the Elephants at some point. I of course still don't know really what it's going to be about, but I'm like, I'm torn, because, like, do you make an audiobook about a book about a podcast? You don't do that, right?
You can. There's no rules, baby.
Right. We're writing it ourselves, motherfucker. Thanks, dude. I really appreciate this. And this is super fun, and you should come back on soon, and we should talk about more shit.
I would love that, man. Anytime. Let me know.